This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, how our military and foreign policy will change. When President-elect Obama introduced his national security team in Chicago yesterday, he said something that some analysts believe may come back to haunt him.
One of the dangers in a White House, based on my reading of history, is that you get wrapped up in groupthink, and everybody agrees with everything, and there's no discussion, and there are no dissenting views. So I'm going to be welcoming a vigorous debate inside the White House.
So how will the new president's team, Clinton at State, Jones at NSA, Gates at the Pentagon, and Rice at the UN, execute his vision? How will they influence it? How much do we know so far about what the president-elect's foreign policy and military strategy is? As his new team gets to work, we've asked three guests with different areas of expertise to weigh in on his choices. Douglas McGregor is a retired colonel in the U.S. Army and senior military fellow at National Defense University. He's currently president of Glenside Analysis, Inc., and he's with us this morning from Virginia. Colonel, good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks.
Stephen Flanagan is with us as well. He's senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he joins us this morning from Washington. Mr. Flanagan, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Happy to be with you.
Later in the hour, Richard Stoll is going to join us. He's a professor of political science at Rice University. He'll be with us from Houston. Colonel McGregor, take a look at the team as a whole and tell me whether you think the new president is going to get the kind of vigorous debate that he wants. Are these people, Clinton, Gates, Rice, Jones, who will tell it like it is to him?
Well, I think for an answer, you have to look at a couple of things. So first of all, the word that is being flung around inside the Beltway is continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And continuity is Washington speak for business as usual. So I think from the vantage point of most people inside the Beltway, these appointments are sort of welcome as indicating little or no change. Now, let's exclude Ambassador Rice at the United Nations from this because I think she has a special relationship with the president and her views are a little different from the rest. But I would not associate significant change with any of these individuals. In fact, this issue of I want vigorous debate is certainly a tribute to his willingness to listen to contrasting views, but I think many of the people that voted for him are going to wonder what he's up to, since they seem to think that the debate ended on the 4th of November.
Colonel, do you believe, though, that then their views among this new team do not differ very much from the new president's and that they don't differ that much from each other's?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure we know what President-elect Obama really thinks, and I think that's part of the problem. We've heard him make many statements, but as far as a coherent prescription for where he thinks U.S. foreign and security policy need to go is something that's entirely absent. And I would not expect, for instance, Secretary of Defense Gates, who's been an advocate for persistent warfare, the notion that we would fight for years, if not decades, against Muslims who are arrayed against us to change. I would not expect Senator Clinton, who has been an outspoken advocate for interventionism in the past, grounded on different reasons, humanitarian intervention and so forth, but nevertheless, a liberal interventionist, I would not expect her views to change. And General Jones, quite frankly, is someone who owes his position to Senator Bill Cohen's influence, who was the former Secretary of Defense, and he's very much an executive type. He doesn't express very many views. He's not associated with any particular views. So at the end of the day, what can we expect? I think at least in the interim, probably more of the same.
Steve Flanagan, do you think the president-elect is right to be concerned about this idea of groupthink, as he described it yesterday in Chicago? I thought that was basically people that were afraid to tell the president what they really thought because they might lose their job. I didn't realize it was people who get into kind of a frame of mind where they all start agreeing about things. But is that a legitimate concern?
Well, I think what he was trying to send was the message that, well, he wants to see harmony. It's important to have harmony within the national security team and an ability to work together once the policy disputes and differences are settled and once he's decided. And I think what you see is actually a team that has been heavily involved in the idea that what you want is a strong presidential direction of foreign policy. And a number of these appointments have been involved in some work that has been focused on the idea that we really need to, one of the key problems of the last administration was the lack of coherent direction coming from the White House, from the National Security Council. And I think what we're going to see is a strong National Security Council directing overall policy with what will be a vigorous debate still among the key players within the administration. And I don't think this, I think the notion that these are people with fairly similar views and rather vanilla kind of approach to policy is really overstated. I think you're going to see there are some important differences that they'll have in approach and emphasis. But I do think what you will see, and I differ here with Doug McGregor, is first of all there is going to be a much greater commitment to multilateral engagement, to working closely with key allies and partners, and with international institutions among all those individuals that are part of this team. But I also think that you will see a major shift in emphasis in General Jones has authored a number of studies. Senator Clinton and others have been also critical of strategy in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I do think you're going to see some new approaches that are going to be undertaken as the shift in the weight of effort to the countering the insurgency in Afghanistan and disengagement from Iraq over time. So I think some of this has been happening already at the end of the Bush administration, led by Secretary Gates and others, but I think you're going to see a more pronounced shift towards a re-emphasis on alliance relationships, on working with and better orchestration of all of the instruments of national power, that not only in government but also other aspects of the private sector and individuals that can help advance U.S. interests in the world.
Hey, Colonel, let me pick up on something that Steve Flanagan said. I cannot imagine that Senator Clinton, as Secretary of State, is going to pursue some of the similar policies that Condoleezza Rice did, this idea that if you have a country that does not align with your views and doesn't share your values, Syria, Iran come to mind, that you simply do not have any kind of diplomatic negotiations. I think Senator Clinton would disagree with that.
Well, let's hope so, because certainly during the first Clinton administration, there was plenty of evidence for the willingness to use force against anyone they didn't like and anyone who didn't agree with them.
Well, such as?
Serbia. During the disintegration of Yugoslavia, Serbia was demonized. We intervened initially in Bosnia-Herzegovina and then launched a 78-day bombing campaign against Serbia. And most Europeans didn't think it was necessary. I was involved with it. I didn't think it was necessary. So I don't think that we should assume that there are that many differences. I mean, for instance, Condoleezza Rice will tell you that American values are universal. They're not. They're English-speaking values. They're not even European, per se, and they certainly aren't universal, and the world doesn't want to hear that. Well, Hillary Clinton is in the same boat. She thinks that American values are universal and is quite willing to use whatever influence she has to try to impose those, and she's bragged about it. Bragged about it during her election campaign for the nomination by talking or referring everybody to her speech in China where she berated the Chinese about human rights.
Steve Flanagan, do you think that's true?
Well, I think there is definitely a commitment to liberal internationalism that runs through the thread of all of these appointments, but I do think that there has been a reassessment of democracy promotion, and we won't see the kind of effort that the Bush administration made in making it the lead. I think it won't be as much as the leading element of policy in an effort to, the perception in the world that was out there that the United States was engaged in a rather forceful democracy promotion to the extent to which, as you said, either we wouldn't engage with countries that weren't pursuing certain democratic values, or that we would try to isolate and bully countries that, into accepting certain principles and standards. I think what we're going to see is a continued emphasis on support to democracy and human rights, but without quite the same sort of a hard edge to it that we saw in the Bush administration, where there was almost an effort to use kind of coercive methods in the way in which foreign assistance was being doled out, in the way in which even relationships were being conducted to try to create the sense that you wouldn't get very far with the United States unless you accepted certain principles of your internal governance. sense.
Colonel, a word about Gates here before we turn to the phones. He stays on at the Pentagon for a year or 18 months, and we know that he was not in favor of a 16-month withdrawal from Iraq, that kind of a timeline. So read between the lines here on what President-elect Obama said as he introduced Gates. He said his new mission will be responsibly ending the war in Iraq through a successful transition to Iraqi control. Whose timeline are we now talking about, Gates or Obama's, or is it changing?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't answer it. I think it's being left deliberately vague. Gates is very much the man who belongs to the four stars. And the four
what
stars,
does that mean?
Well, this is somebody who does not challenge the generals at all under any circumstances. He's very much willing to do their bidding. This is not a dynamic leader dominating defense by any stretch of the imagination. I think what you have to expect right now is something that he's been doing for about 2 years. The generals were very concerned that we would leave Iraq very quickly, because they know that it will unravel. What exists for the moment is a facade that's held together by an awful lot of American money that's being poured into people's pockets. And because the Iranians, who ultimately are the dominant force in the country, are demanding that the Shiites cooperate and essentially wait us out. They know the Kurds have agendas. The Sunni Arabs are going to fight in several directions for what they think they want to retain. The generals are well aware of this, so is Gates. The sooner you leave, the sooner that begins to unfold, and then it becomes extremely difficult to make the argument that you've done something good in Iraq. And I think everyone is interested in trying to conceal the disaster in Iraq.
Well, so does that mean that Gates is able to persuade President-elect Obama to stick it out longer than 16 months, or we don't know?
Well, I don't think we know, but there are a couple of other conditions that need to be taken into account, and Steve has kind of implied two of them. I mean, first of all, the world today bears no resemblance to the world that George Bush became president in 2001. The world is not interested in most of what we have to say and most of what we want to do, to be perfectly blunt. They're not interested in having someone talk to them about democracy and human rights. Much of the world is prepared to move in its own direction. Our position in Iraq has been formally delegitimated by this new agreement, which in Arabic does not say SOFA. It says the agreement on complete withdrawal.
The forces agreement, the status of forces?
It is not a status of forces agreement. The title of it in Arabic is the agreement on complete withdrawal. That was the only way that Maliki could sell it, because everybody wants us out of that country. So our position there is no longer legitimate. The financial crisis has delegitimated us as the financial hegemon. And then finally, there's something else that nobody is bothering to mention. We're spending $700 billion a year on defense. We can't afford it. We don't need to spend it. And we are in financial meltdown. Whatever Gates, whatever Clinton, whatever members of the so-called Obama team want to do, we're broke. We can't do it. And there will be substantial cuts in defense spending, regardless of what these team members want.
As Steve Flanagan, this issue of Iraq, before we go to the phones.
Well, there is definitely a move within Iraq to ensure U.S. withdrawal. I mean, the ground has shifted, and I don't disagree with Doug on that we were moving towards a policy of disengagement, even, you know, and on a more accelerated schedule at the end of the Bush administration's planning for this. But that said, I do think that there's still an enormous interest in retaining that presence there. There's still a lot of uneasiness in the Sunni community, I think, about what happened in the Kurdish community, about what happens when the U.S. disengages. So, you know, the pace of this, I think, will have to be tempered by advances in improvements in the capabilities of the Iraq security forces, which will be a major emphasis. But there's no doubt about it, the resources are going to be less for defense in general. The whole question of how you rebalance the strategy to both deal with, waging a more intensive insurgency in Afghanistan and dealing with other regional contingencies that are out there. This has been a concern that the generals have been bringing up in the context of the current defense and going into the next administration's defense review. How will they balance the potential for some kind of major crisis in Northeast Asia on the Korean Peninsula or with China, another potential flashpoint in the Gulf?
We'll talk about that in just a minute. But it just seems like we're getting such conflicting messages. I mean, President-elect Obama stands up and says, The first mission is going to be for Secretary Gates, as I keep him on, is going to be withdrawing from Iraq. But
yes.
then we hear these other conflicting messages that 16-month timeline that he talked about all through the campaign is really not on the table at this point. Can you discern just what's going on?
Well, I think they haven't yet even had a full briefing on, you know, where things are. They're still getting their team together, trying to look at the assessments. I mean, I do think that President-elect Obama will want to have his team take a look at what the assessments are in terms of the timelines and review the capabilities. General Jones is very familiar. He led a study that was mandated by Congress last year, looking at the capabilities of the Iraq security forces. So he has some strong views on this himself. I'm sure Senator Clinton will want to get briefed on that as well. And then at that point, they can make a reassessment of, is that 16-month timeline realistic? Might there have to be some adjustments in the level of residual force that U.S. retains there as a way to help assist the Iraqis maintain some kind of stability and security within and particularly their borders?
All right. If you're listening in this morning, we're having a conversation about the announcement yesterday in Chicago of President-elect's foreign policy team. And we're taking a look at these individuals as separate entities, but also as how they will work together and how they may affect and influence policy around the world. We've asked a number of guests here with different areas of expertise to weigh in on this. Stephen Flanagan's one of them. He's a senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and with us from Washington. Doug McGregor is back on the show with us. He's a retired colonel in the U.S. Army and currently president of Glenside Analysis, Inc. Richard Stoll is going to join us a bit later, teaches political science at Rice University, will be with us from Houston. If you'd like to join in, if you have questions about how these different individuals will affect and influence policy, how they will work together, where some of the flashpoints are around the world that will demand their attention immediately, 800-242-2828. If you're in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online with us this morning, you want to join in, you can do that. MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. And if you're online today, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Send a Question to Ricardo in Eagan. Hi, your question.
Good morning.
Hi.
Most of which I was going to ask was actually responded to by Mr. Flanagan, but I wanted to ask the colonel with respect to continuity, particularly when you take into consideration that we have these guys who had, I think a lot of people thought that Senator Clinton was going to, once she got to the, that she was going to be a diva, first lady diva, and in fact she became a workhorse. I was curious if they thought that, yes, although all these people have very strong personalities, all of these people have also worked in the bureaucracy that is in Washington, and that given that the mission is being changed, that the commander is being changed, that would, in fact, there be continuity with respect to capacity, but the direction would be different.
All right.
And that because the direction is different, the outcomes may, in fact, be different as
good,
well.
Okay, good question. Colonel, to that point.
Well, first of all, in response to your caller, we're going to have to wait for about 120 to 180 days into the Obama administration to really find out. Let's be frank. He hasn't been very specific. He's been very vague. As you point out, when questions were raised, his answers were not very specific or unambiguous. We simply need to wait and see where this man goes with the individuals he's selected. These people, however, are very much part of the status quo. These are not brilliant innovators, change agents of any kind. And we just need to be clear on that point, because Obama, of course, identified himself very closely with this whole idea of change. The second thing is that I'm afraid that President-elect Obama is going to end up being a reactionary president, in the sense that he's going to have to deal with a lot of events right now that quite frankly, are going to divert his attention away from domestic matters.
Oh, like what?
Well, I think you have a real war, a fourth war between India and Pakistan, very definitely brewing at this point. That has important implications for the whole region. The second thing is that our resources are dramatically diminished. We're not in a position to influence things the way we were. We're not shaping the destiny of Iraq at all. Iraq's destiny is being shaped by the countries around it, principally Iran, and some portion of the population inside that country. And then finally, when you look at a place like Northeast Asia, China is a dominant actor who ultimately restrains North Korea. And these things don't seem to be told to the American people. We operate as though, and in fact, Senator Clinton implied this when she accepted the job as Secretary of State. She very nearly used the phrase indispensable superpower. To be perfectly blunt, we're not the indispensable superpower. We're one of many great powers now.
Stephen Flanagan, this is something I wanted to ask about. While the attacks in Mumbai are front and center here, and as Doug McGregor says, there's a lot of concern about what happens between India and Pakistan, there are other extremely complicated relationships that we have that will also require Hillary Clinton's attention. And I think of countries like China and Russia. Isn't that going to occupy a lot of her time?
Absolutely. The whole question of redefining at a time when indeed China's influence is rising, where Russia is somewhat resurgent, although it's been tempered of late by the drop in energy prices because a lot of Russia's new influence and ability to make mischief around the world has been driven by the energy revenues that it's been collecting. But I do think I disagree with Doug in the sense that I don't think it means that American power is completely diminished or somehow, but it is a more complicated, somehow that we're undone and we're no longer. We're still the predominant power in the world. We don't have as unfettered a kind of a reach across different regions. We do have to counter the. We do have to deal with the rise of China's capacity to influence events in East Asia, in particular, its global reach. But China has also been hit by the whole world has been hit by this economic downturn, and their export-driven economy has also taken a big hit. Russia has taken a huge hit in both the financial markets and the drop in energy prices. So everyone's recoiling and trying to rebalance and understand, you know, what the limits of their capacities are right now. But there's no doubt about it. Russia has been trying to reassert both a sphere of influence along its periphery and to develop some old relationships with Medvedev's visit recently in Latin America. He's rekindled ties to Syria. The Russians have made it clear that they are about challenging the nature of the international system, and they've made no bones about it. The Chinese have been a little more subtle about it. The Chinese have been talking about regional cooperation, growth of trade. They've been providing more of a soft power kind of approach, but also somewhat challenging U.S. global leadership. So there is no doubt about it. Those relationships are going to have to be continue to be attended. I think the good news is actually the China legacy that the Bush administration leaves is actually quite good. There's very unlikely that there's going to be major tensions with China. The relationship has been on a pretty good course. With Russia, though, that is actually, I think, going to Russia and Iran are going to be two of the key issues at the top of Secretary of State designate Clinton's agenda, and the policy reviews on those are going to be very contentious.
Let me take another call here from Roseanne in St. Paul. Hi, Roseanne, your question.
Good morning, Carrie. I appreciate you taking my call,
sure.
And I'm enjoying the discussion very much. I like the fact that you have a pretty good balance between both of your guests in terms of their viewpoints. One of the things that might be helpful will be to me and maybe others is if in discussing the upcoming and the future possibilities of the president-elect, your guests will include a little bit more of background, historical facts. Some of us, like I say, probably aren't up to speed in the same way that they are.
So as in how Senator Clinton might have voted in the Senate, but what does that tell us about
exactly
how she'd serve?
Exactly.
Doug McGregor, what does background tell us about future?
Well, I think we touched on this at the beginning, and that is that we cannot expect someone like Hillary Clinton, who has had very strong positions on a range of issues, whether it's Israel and the Arab-Israeli dispute, or it's this issue of human rights and advancing democracy overseas, even at gunpoint. These are people who advocate nation-building with military power, something which in the world outside of Western Europe and North America is viewed as a euphemism for imperialism. These are things that I would not expect to see change. I'd be very surprised. I mean, the same thing is true for Secretary Gates. Secretary Gates has very strongly internalized or inhaled, or at least it would seem to be the case,
these notions of persistent warfare, that somehow or another we're going to occupy more Muslim Arab countries and start rebellions against ourselves and suppress them, calling them counterinsurgencies, presumably paying large numbers of people not to shoot at us, as we have in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Either these individuals are going to suddenly shed their historic views and behavior and adopt an entirely new outlook, or we're going to see tension. We're going to see a struggle, and President Obama is going to have to sort through it.
Doug McGregor continues with us into the second half of our conversation when Richard Stoll is going to be with us, professor of political science at Rice University. Stephen Flanagan, thanks so much for the time. I hope you'll come back.
Sure. Happy to be with you today.
Steve Flanagan, senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and with us from Washington. We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, continue our conversation as we talk about the people that President-elect Barack Obama named to his foreign policy team yesterday in Chicago, trying to get a sense of what we know about them, what their approach to military and foreign policy will be, how they will work together. That was a big issue in the Bush administration, especially between defense and state. So we'll dig into that a little further. And you can join us, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And if you're online this morning, MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and click on Send a Question to the newsroom. And Tony Randolph. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Carrie. Stocks have been holding steady so far this morning after showing some modest gains at the opening bell. Buyers may be searching for bargains after yesterday's drop of nearly 680 points in the Dow. Still, some financial stocks are falling amid ongoing concerns about the sector's health. Today's the day Detroit's automakers must tell Congress their plans for staying in business. The head of the United Auto Workers tells a Detroit radio station the union hasn't approved any cutbacks, but admits sacrifices may be required. There's $25 billion in federal funding at stake. India's foreign minister tells reporters a military response to last week's terror attacks isn't even on the table. 10 gunmen are said to have been trained at a militant camp in Pakistan, but officials in both countries are doing their best to avoid a troop buildup along their shared border. A new report says the U.S. should expect a terrorist attack using nuclear or biological weapons sometime by 2013. The report is due for release tomorrow, and the bipartisan commission behind it is urging President-elect Barack Obama to improve the nation's ability to respond to such an attack. In regional news, businessman Tom Petters plans to plead not guilty to a federal indictment today in U.S. District Court in St. Paul. A federal grand jury has indicted Petters and two of his companies on fraud, conspiracy, and money laundering charges. The indictment supersedes criminal charges filed against Petters earlier. Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback is calling for a citywide hiring freeze. Minnesota's largest city is trying to deal with the economic downturn. The city council is expected to vote on the proposal on December 12th. It'll be mostly cloudy today with a chance of snow, some freezing drizzle, and rain. Highs will be from the upper 20s to the low 40s. Right now, it's 21 in Rochester, 21 in Duluth, 24 in St. Cloud, and in the Twin Cities.
Hey, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
You know, there's more than one way to help Minnesota Public Radio.
Are they asking us to quit again?
No. If you have a car you don't need anymore, you can now donate it to Minnesota Public Radio and get a tax break.
Can I get first dibs on the rusty ones?
No, not a chance. To learn more, go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and thanks.
Support for this program comes from National Dizzy and Balance Center, offering hospital-level diagnostics in an outpatient setting, treating vertigo, dizziness, and balance disorders. Locations in Edina, Coon Rapids, and downtown St. Paul. Online at StopDizziness.com.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Vernon Jordan is going to be with us, longtime civil rights activist, super lawyer, confidant to President Bill Clinton, out with a new book called Make It Plain that reprises some of the speeches that he gave when he was front and center in the fight for civil rights. So we're going to talk with him at 10 o'clock. Should be an interesting conversation. At tomorrow at 10, Daniel Levitin is going to join us, scientist and musician. He was a member of some studio work with Blue Oyster Cult and Stevie Wonder and Santana.
and then went back to delve into neuroscience. And he's going to talk with us about the brain research that he's doing at McGill University, the Special Center on Brain Research, and how music, he believes, highly influenced the evolution of our brains. Fascinating book. It's called Six Songs in the World. So we'll talk with Daniel Levitin tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and we'll listen to a lot of music with him. He's got some very interesting views about specific songs, what he has to say about Johnny Cash's I Walk the Line and other music. So that's tomorrow at 10. I hope you'll listen in. Back to our conversation this hour. We're talking about Barack Obama's new foreign policy team, what we know about their views on military and foreign strategy, how they'll work together. And we're bringing Richard Stoll into the conversation with us. He's a professor of political science at Rice University. Professor, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
President-elect Obama said that as he introduced this new team, they share my pragmatism about the use of power and my sense of purpose about America's role as a leader in the world. Now, Doug McGregor has told us it's hard to know just what Barack Obama thinks about that. Do you have a clearer view?
Well, my guess is that we are not going to see a gigantic break from some of the current foreign policy practices. That I think when presidents get into office, they discover it's harder to change things around than they thought. But what I took away from that comment was that he believes that, for example, there's only so much you can do with military force. A part of the conversation so far has been on the situation in Iraq.
Yes.
And the problems that have been pointed out, which I think are quite accurate, have little to do with the amount of military force that's there and much to do with the other kinds of the other parts of the problem in Iraq. So I think we have to understand the limitations of using military force, and there's only so much we can use it for.
We have not talked about Afghanistan yet, and as Colonel McGregor pointed out to us, Barack Obama has said that he wants to shift military troops from Iraq and into Afghanistan. Have we got some ideas about how this team might advise him on that issue and what it's going to mean to increasingly commit military troops and get deeper into the war there?
Well, I presume that what's going to have to happen is that maybe we can move some troops there very quickly, but ultimately being able to keep a much larger force in Afghanistan, I think, is dependent on drawing down our forces in Iraq. Whether because of the so-called status of forces agreement or just President Obama deciding to withdraw troops anyway. I also believe that the President-elect Obama will make a big pitch to particularly to our NATO allies to increase their forces. And, since he is not President Bush, and if he goes about it in the right way, at least he may have a bit of a chance to get other countries to contribute more than they are contributing now.
You think there might be some open minds internationally to that?
I don't think that most countries want to see Afghanistan collapse. On the other hand, they're probably reluctant to commit their military forces and see their people being killed. But I think a new American president, sort of starting fresh, at least has a fighting chance to convince other countries to pour more resources into Afghanistan.
Colonel, tell me about the dilemmas that await President-elect Obama in Afghanistan. As he has said, he wants to put more military troops there.
Well, Afghanistan is a narco state. Karzai's brother and his entire family has enriched themselves as a result of taking over in Kabul. His brother is heavily engaged in the drug trafficking. Drug trade has now dominates Afghanistan on a scale that was never true in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The government that we've set up, our puppet, quote-unquote, Karzai, has no legitimacy in the country anymore. One of the reasons for the so-called Taliban resurgence has been the widespread discontent with him and the corruption that characterizes his regime. So the question that I ask routinely is, what are we ultimately trying to accomplish today in Afghanistan?
Right. So what do you think it is?
Well, I'm not sure. I think, again, we're in the same sort of dilemma that we have in Iraq. Instead of getting out, having accomplished the initial objectives we set for ourselves, we decided to occupy the place and stay in perpetuity, transforming Arabs into Anglo-Saxons, which had absolutely no chance of success, as we've seen. Now we seem to want to stay in Afghanistan for similar purposes. I think it's a huge mistake. I don't think that we should be waging war on the Afghan population, which I think is increasingly going to turn out to be the case.
And I think we've got to seek some sort of political solution that allows us to disengage. And the other point that we need to keep in mind is that our position in Afghanistan depends very heavily on our forces in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
We depend on Pakistan and our position there for fuel and water and food and everything else. We have no access anymore through Central Asia because of how we've treated Russia over the last several years. And I, by the way, I didn't get a chance to say this, but I strongly disagree with Flanagan's characterization of Russia as some sort of enemy that is making mischief. We're the ones who have been tinkering on their borders, and they have every right to be concerned about their own security.
But you don't disagree with the idea that they are aligning themselves with other countries, Venezuela, other countries that have interests that would not necessarily align with the United States's, do you?
Well,
I think that they're making some strategic alliances there.
Well, I don't think there's much of a strategic alliance between Venezuela and Russia. Russia is extremely weak, but I think Russia has done, as it said, we're going to show you that if you insist on tinkering on our borders and creating trouble for us by creating alternative power centers that threaten our interests, we are going to tinker in your neighborhood. I think it's a more of a quid pro quo, tit for tat. It's not something that the Russians would normally do, to be perfectly blunt. I don't see any particular reason why we and the Russians should not be on good terms.
Richard, so I know you were listening to that part of the conversation. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, imagine things from the Russian point of view. There's this thing called NATO, which was put together to defend Western Europe against the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union disappears. And what happens? Not only does NATO not disappear, but it gets larger, and it starts bringing in countries closer and closer to the borders of Russia. Now, from our point of view, we may see this as being pretty benign. It's no big deal. But, you know, it can't help but make Russia nervous. And the anti-ballistic missile systems that we're installing, we see these as being basically a hedge against an Iranian or capacity. But, it looks bad to the Russians. So I'm not surprised that they are sort of trying to tweak us. I do agree that there's no reason to believe that we can't work out some kind of an arrangement. But we have to understand that it does look like we keep creeping forward towards their borders, even if that is not what our intent is. It sure looks that way to their side.
To the phones, to Josh in Grand Forks. Hi, Josh, and thanks for waiting. Your question?
Yes, I would like to hear the colonel maybe comment about Hillary Clinton's past record in the Senate may have been driven by her need to posture herself for her presidential run. Now that that has not taken place, and then obviously it probably won't ever take place, she may be completely different. It may not be fair to say that because she was hawkish in the Senate that she'll be hawkish as the Secretary of State, because her motives may have been to what she felt would be best for her presidential run. And maybe the political science professor could comment on it as well.
Josh, thanks. Good question. Colonel?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, the caller makes a good point. We have no way of knowing. It depends on whose opinion you want to take. Do you want to listen to Christopher Hitchens, who, leads a relentless campaign of attack on the Clintons for all sorts of reasons?
Yeah.
Or do you want to listen to people who are unabashed admirers of this woman? I have no idea. My point is you can only look at what people have historically said and done and then assume that unless there is some sort of born-again revelation that is going to divert them down a new path, they're likely to persist. This is the problem in a place like Afghanistan. If we were to step back from Afghanistan, look at it very rationally and objectively, we would ask, what is it that we are really trying to accomplish now? Are we there because of Al-Qaeda? Are we there because we don't like the fact that the Taliban are fighting back? What is our ultimate long-term strategic purpose? And what good would more conventional forces do in that country? If anything, our experience in Iraq is that the more American combat troops you pour in, the more anger, frustrility, hostility, and frustration you create. So why would you want to do that? I mean, these are the questions that Obama needs to ask. He needs to say, what's the purpose? And what's the end state? What are we trying to achieve? And I haven't heard anybody discuss any of those issues.
And Professor Stoll, what judging or trying to define how Secretary of State Clinton will advise the new president on some of these issues that the colonel is talking about, can we look at her record in the Senate and say, yes, we know which way she'll go? Or is it, as Josh suggests, as she was positioning herself for a run for president and had to be hawkish?
Well, I'll be a standard academic and say a little of both. I mean, I think that, you know, for example, if you're going to run for statewide office in New York, the Jewish vote is very important. So, you know, anyone running for a statewide office in New York is going to be very pro-Israeli. On the other hand, I don't think that she's like a closet, you know, Israel hater. I think what you saw in the Senate and her political campaigns is somewhat close to what her beliefs are, but again, she's not the president. So one of the challenges here for President-elect Obama is that when people come to him and say, "Mr. President, we ought to be doing this, we ought to be doing that,"
right?
You know, will he say, "Okay, you're the Secretary of State, I guess you know what you're talking about," or will he say, "Well, I appreciate your advice, but I think we're going to chart a somewhat different course"?
Judging by what he said yesterday, it sounded where he was saying the buck stops here. I'll take advice, but I'm the one who makes the decision. Seems like he's kind of laying down some markers there, doesn't it?
Yeah, and as the colonel has suggested, you know, you're going to have to watch for at least half a year to figure out sort of how things are going to play out. But, you know, again, these people work for the president of the United States, and, you know, he doesn't have to do what they say. Now, if you continually disagree with what the president wants to do, at some point I think you have to leave the administration. But, you know, if he's his own person, then he's not going to just sort of parrot the line that any of his particular advisors give him. But it's always a challenge to manage these things. Historically, of course, it has often been the case, for example, that the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense have, at a minimum, offered different policy advice.
Well, that's what happened with the Bush administration.
Well, yeah, but, and that's not the only case. And that spilled over to, it seems to me, almost a personal antipathy there. But it's the job of the president and the chief of staff and the national security advisor to get the most out of these people with their different views, but keep them on the reservation, so to speak, and make sure that people feel that even if they lose a particular policy debate, they get a full and fair hearing and they're willing to continue. I think the Bush administration became somewhat dysfunctional and people felt like they were being cut out of the process, and that's a bad sign.
Colonel, to follow up on that, here's online from Chris in Wayzata, says, "General Jones must run a strong NSC staff system to advise Obama. Clinton and Bush had weak ones and poor foreign policies in part as a result." Do you agree with that?
Well, only partially. I think that, first of all, Vice President Cheney ran the National Security Council, not Condoleezza Rice. And Vice President Cheney is the man who's ultimately shaped the foreign and security policy agendas for President Bush. So I think there's been a very strong hand there and a very small group of people making decisions. And to be blunt with you, if you have real goals and you want to accomplish something, that's how you do it. The notion of maintaining a National Security Council that is going to steer foreign and security policy on behalf of the president, I think, is a prescription for failure. Now, what will General Jones do? Again, I think he's a very fine executive.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's known for. If you go back through his career, that's the kind of thing he's done. And he can certainly ensure that information reaches the president. Now, what will he advise? I think in most cases he's predisposed to advise caution and restraint. That's probably a very good thing. We just don't know what it means. And again, my fear is that the president wants, probably, President-elect Obama wants to do probably what Bob Woodward has said. He wants to kind of put foreign and security policy on automatic pilot in some respects so that he can focus domestically. That's Woodward's contention. He may be right. That can't be done. That won't work. The president has to drive those, and he can have more influence in foreign and security policy, frankly, than he can domestically over the economy, which is beyond his ability to dramatically influence.
Colonel, one thing we do know that Jim Jones wants to do, because he's on the record, is saying close Guantanamo as soon as possible. Barack Obama has talked about that. Do you think that is something that they will do, what, in those first 100 days or sooner?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think Guantanamo.
You think that happens quickly?
Yeah, he's definitely going to do that. There's no question about that. You know, the real issue is, what do you do about this bloated $700 billion defense budget that is just eating away at our resources? It's causing us to go deeper into debt. And remember, our creditors are largely in Northeast Asia. The Chinese are going to be looking for changes in our behavior, which they think are necessary for our own fiscal stability, to which they are also linked.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what are you going to do about that? Is Gates the man to help you reduce the defense budget? This is a good question. We haven't seen Gates
even address these issues. And we have a bloated defense budget. We're spending billions on things we absolutely don't need.
To Bob in St. Paul. Hi, Bob.
Hey, thanks a lot. I really appreciated what your guest was saying about Afghanistan in terms of it seems like no one's really asking the big question about why, you know, does it make sense to stay there and to commit more to it. I'm wondering if there's more, do you think there's more groupthink already that's kind of hardened into place in regard to that? I mean, what's the likelihood that the administration is going to actually have a debate about what to do or not do in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I'll ask you both this. Colonel, weigh in first, if you will.
Well, we don't know. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much evidence for debate at the moment. Again, we haven't heard anyone stand up and question the wisdom of what we've been doing anywhere. And that's what's most disturbing, I think, right now. What needs to happen is that President Obama needs to say, why? Why are we doing this? Why is it necessary? And how does it help the interests and the people of the United States, first of all?
But is the answer that if you don't do something about Afghanistan, then it goes back to the kind of sanctuary for terrorism that ultimately led to 9/11?
Well, that's really the question, isn't it? You know, you can find many, many people who will tell you that getting out of the place is probably something you can do now because it may not go back to that particular sanctuary. But again, if you want to cut some sort of arrangement that can survive the withdrawal of your military power, then you're going to have to sit down and talk to people that you otherwise, to this point, have said you won't speak to. But there's something else we need to keep in mind. None of these countries are strong entities. There's nothing to prevent us from moving into Afghanistan, Iraq, or any of these places if we choose to do so, if we think there is a viable terrorist threat there and destroy it.
You mean pulling out and coming back?
Well, yeah, but coming back how? I mean, the problem that we've had is this obsession with occupying other people's territory. That's the problem. That needs to stop. That's expensive and ultimately counterproductive. It doesn't prevent you from moving into a place where you are certain there is a threat and destroying it. But you don't stay. You absolutely do not stay anywhere in the Muslim world.
Professor Stoll, back to Bob's question, this idea of whether groupthink about Afghanistan is hardened to the point where no one's asking the kinds of questions that the colonel and you are bringing up.
Well, I think certainly current policy has been sort of drifting along, and I think it's really up to President-elect Obama to tell his national security team, I need you to think this through and, you know, and put more options on the table. I think if he gives them that direction, then, you know, things will be considered. I think if he suggests to them that we just need to do what we're doing but be better at it, i.e. more troops, then we'll see a continuation more or less of the current policy, possibly with higher troop levels.
You know, that sounds like what he was talking about on the campaign trail.
Well, you know, I think that I don't think people campaigning for president sort of lie about things, but I think the picture can look very different once you're in office. The most classic example of that was Jimmy Carter, when he campaigned for president, was really, really insistent that the U.S. needed to remove all its troops from South Korea. But when he got into office, after hearing from enough different people, he discovered that maybe that wasn't such a great idea. You know, I think it's up to the president-elect to set the right tone and say, I need you to consider a broad set of options for Afghanistan, not just continuing the current policy with a bit more muscle. If he tells them that, I think they will generate options, and then we'll see where we go. If he suggests that he just wants to continue on, then I think we're pretty much stuck there for a long period of time, possibly with higher levels of troops.
We had a news item during the break about this new report that's going to be released tomorrow that says expect a terrorist attack that involves nuclear weapons by the year 2013. How does a brand new president even get his arms around the idea of something like that, Professor?
Well, I think that that is a serious threat. I'm not sure 2013 is the magical date or anything like that, but you know, we know there are groups out there that are seeking to develop weapons of mass destruction or to buy them and have no qualms about using them. So it's a genuine threat, and I think in the long run, you know, your best defense against that is better intelligence, so you know where these folks are, and as the colonel suggested, you can go get them. Now, I think the problem, however, that sort of lies behind it is And I'm not saying you can manipulate things to achieve some kind of stability, but if you don't in some of these areas, you're going to have to keep going back time after time again. To shift to a more minor issue, you know, there's been an increase in piracy, right, off of Somalia. Well, you know, why don't we do something about that? Well, you could go ashore and sort of clean out the areas where the pirates are. But Somalia has no government and has not had a government of any kind for a number of years. Unless something is ultimately done about that, if you go in and clean out the sanctuaries for the pirates, you're just going to have to go back later on. Now, if you can't create a government or facilitate the creation of a government in Somalia, maybe that's the best you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, if these places don't get a reasonable level of government that is working, the problems will continue and we'll have to keep going back.
Colonel, we talk about all these myriad foreign policy challenges that the new president-elect's administration faces, and then something like this report cuts through all of that and says you may have on your plate a terrorist group that is able to get a nuclear weapon by the year 2013.
Well, listen, first of all, just to finish up on what Professor Stoll said earlier, the supposition that we need to move away from is that we can establish governments in other people's countries that will work. Government is something that develops organically, indigenously. It's not something that can be imposed from outside. So the truth is that we're going to end up periodically launching punitive operations against enemies that we think threaten our interests and the interests of our allies, and we should be accustomed to that. That's nothing new. This has been going on for thousands of years. Most of the world, frankly, has been dominated by failed states, not by successful ones, and I don't see that that's going to change dramatically. Now, as far as our borders are concerned, first of all, the United States Coast Guard is doing a superb job of protecting the ocean approaches and the waterways in the United States. The problem is the Coast Guard is under-equipped, undermanned, and overstretched. The next piece of news that's bad is that we have no land equivalent of the United States Coast Guard.
Yeah.
We're talking about expanding the Army and the Marines, which we absolutely don't need to do for the purpose of occupying other people's countries. This has been the Gates mantra. In reality, what we need is the equivalent of the Coast Guard on land to secure the land borders. These borders, waterways, approaches are simply not secure. And if someone really wants to get into the United States with a biological weapon, even if they were to bring in people who are simply already infected with some terrible disease and allow them to move freely among our population before we recognize what was happening, we're not in a position to deal with these things right now. And again, this is something else that where President Obama is going to have to make some choices. And I just don't know that the people that he's currently appointed are thinking in those terms. I think that just as the Bush appointees, quite frankly, were accurately described as cold warriors who thought in cold war terms, I'm beginning to wonder whether or not we're seeing people who think in terms that people did 10 years ago about nation building with military power and interventions all over the place to establish what we think is appropriate in other people's countries, when in reality the issues that you've just brought up are far more important.
Let's talk again in the first 6 months of the administration when perhaps we know more. I appreciate the time from both of you. Thank you so much. Doug McGregor, Richard Stoll, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Douglas McGregor is a retired colonel in the U.S. Army, senior military fellow at National Defense University, currently president of Glenside Analysis, Inc., with us this morning from Virginia. Richard Stoll joined us, professor of political science at Rice University, and with us from Houston. At 10 o'clock, Vernon Jordan joins us. He's out with a new book called Make It Plain. It's a reprisal, if you will, of some of the key speeches that he gave when he was deeply involved in the civil rights movement. He was mentored by Thurgood Marshall. He rose to be president of the NAACP, had a lot of involvement in trying to agitate, if you will, for civil rights, and then ended up going back to the law full time. We'll talk about the arc of his career, and of course we want to talk about what he thinks about the new election of the president. So we'll talk about that at 10 tomorrow. Daniel Levitin is with us. Neuroscience and music. What an interesting conversation. That's tomorrow at 10. This is Mid-Morning.